introduce our speaker, and they say in Alcoholics Anonymous that nobody has the power to get anybody drunk, and no one has the power to get anybody sober. Well, I don't know if I agree with that. This person's had the power to keep me sober because she'd tell me she'd kill me if I didn't. So, and I listened to her. So I'm going to introduce her, someone I love very much, and I'm looking forward to hearing. Sam.
My name's Sam. I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a drug addict and a compulsive overeater. First of all, I would like to say that I apologize for anybody that I will offend. Because I always have somebody. I know that there's people in this room that don't believe that we should talk about anything other than alcohol in Alcoholics Anonymous. However, I believe that for me to do so would be telling a half-truth, and that would mean that I would sit here and I would stand here and I would not only lie to you, but I would lie to myself about who I am and where I came from and what I go through. So with that, I would like to ask, I have a terrible throat, and it's so if you can just kind of hang down on your smoking a little bit. If I start coughing, I won't be able to stop, and which might be to your benefit. I think it's real important that you know about some of the stuff that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with, because I came here with stuff other than alcoholism, and I think we all did. And it was a real setup for me to walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and think that just because I took alcohol and drugs out of my system, I would find God and live happily ever after. Because that's not the way my story goes. Who I was, well, it's not so much who I was, who my daddy was. He was an alcoholic and a womanizer and a compulsive gambler. And he was Irish, you know? If anybody in the room is Irish, they understand. I mean, so what, you know? Every Irishman I've ever known was an alcoholic, a womanizer, and a compulsive gambler. My daddy died at 25 years old on a drunken motorcycle bike before I was born, and I never met the man. But I have always known that I am my daddy's daughter. Now, he was so bad, or at least my mother perceived him as so bad, that I was never allowed to speak of him. I never saw a picture of him until I was over 30 years old. His name was not brought up. And because I was my father's daughter, you can imagine what I thought of myself. If he was that bad, then I must be that bad too. And I was, you know. I just lived it out. I lived out my little fantasy. Everybody else in this house that I grew up with was these grossly nice people. Now, at least everybody else thought they were nice. I thought they were incredibly boring people, to tell you the truth. My mother is an untreated Al-Anon, and my stepfather was a practicing asshole. and that's the type of environment I was raised in. I was not allowed to yell, I was not allowed to cry, I was not allowed to laugh, I was not allowed to have an opinion. Because I was a girl child, I was basically worth nothing. All I was how I looked. And nothing else was important. The only people that were important in my home were the male people. And I hated it. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous filled with hate and resentment and fear and frustration and anger. And believe me, you knew it, because I didn't come in here smiling. One of the first things that I learned way back when I was a little shit was that I needed some goals for myself, and one of those goals was going to be that I was never going to get hurt. I wasn't going to let those assholes hurt me, that they weren't going to do it. Now, my sister played a different game. My older sister played the game of, you know, get one little tap on your butt, scream your head off, and they won't hit you again. Yeah, you had a sister like that too, right, Trimble? We still don't like them very much. And me, I would just stare at this man when he started whapping on my ass, and I would just look at him and I think to myself, you can't hurt me, you son of a bitch. And I didn't know the words, thank God, because it would have killed me. But I just would think, you can't hurt me. And that's how I went through life. You can't hurt me, and you're not going to get me. And somehow I'm going to survive this, and I don't know how I'm going to do it. But those were my survival mechanisms, you know. Somehow I knew I wasn't going to let this family destroy whoever I was. Now, they basically destroyed the rest of the kids. My sisters and brother are still doing whatever they can do to please Papa, you know. And thank God this program has given me the strength that I don't have to play those kind of games. And I don't have to even be angry with him anymore. That took up too much energy, you know. But back then, that was my whole game plan. I started drinking when I was 15 years old, and I was instant alcoholic. And I just never drank successfully. Who would want to? It didn't make any sense to me why somebody would want to drink successfully, whatever that meant. You know, just have a couple drinks and stop. How boring, how incredibly boring. But I could drink and I could get drunk and I could be wonderful. I was witty, wise, and wonderful. At least I thought I was. What helped me with that was at 18 I got turned on to prescription Dexedrine. And that was my drug of choice next to alcohol. Dexedrine allowed me to drink the way that I needed to drink and not fall down, you know, and not slur my words and be high energy and quick-witted and wonderful. I loved it. And I had a stable of doctors going. Also behind speed, which Dexedrine is, and when I couldn't get Dex, I would get anything, or even when I could, I'd get anything. The only time I ever lost jobs was behind speed. I mean, I go crazy. And it's a crazy that I hated and I loved, because it made me fast. You know, it made me quick. It gave me the kind of energy that this little couch potato just doesn't get normally. I don't want to get too much into what I did, you know, in my drinking, because we all basically did the same stuff. I was listening to Sherry a couple weeks ago, and she was talking about being an overachiever, and just cracked me up. I mean, I was my whole game plan was to be an underachiever. You know, I would do whatever I had to do so that you wouldn't expect too much of me. And it's worked real well. I mean, I've had many, many, many major careers in my life. And I'd get up to here, you know, borderline mediocre, and I'd go off and do something else. You know, just kept going. I'm a great starter. I start things wonderful. I have never finished anything in my life. You know, I guess it's real important for me to let you know a little bit about who I was, so you can understand that my message, the only message that I have, is that it is such an incredible miracle that a person such as myself stayed sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I didn't have a chance in hell. That's not what I did. I didn't follow through on things. I never did anything that caused me any pain. I didn't get close to people. I didn't trust people. I was just out there living my little life. You know, damn the consequences, full speed ahead. I did what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it, and I just kept moving. At 20-some years old, 20, I get so confused. Oh, I remember, 23 years old, I got sick. Now, I don't know what you women do when you get sick. I mean, I got sick, you know. I got sick and tired of being sick and tired. Now, when I get sick and tired of being sick and tired, I'd get married. Well, it always worked for me, you know. I wouldn't have to work so hard if I'd get married. 23 years old, I got married. God only knows why. I mean, this marriage lasted 10 weeks. That was a long-term relationship for me, too, I might add. You know, it was an even longer-term relationship for him, trust me. He left me, which just shocked the shit out of me. I mean, I really thought I was wonderful. I had never made love to him, I want you to know. That was not part of what I wanted to do with this man. He wasn't pleased. I've never been sure if it was that or the fact that every night for 10 weeks I gave him canned chili with cheese on it. Now, I've never believed that women have to cook. I don't see anything in the marriage certificate that says women cook, you know? And these suckers want to believe it when they give you the ring, you know. So anyway, that lasted 10 weeks. He split. I had what I call an emotional break, and of which I've had several. But my emotional breaks, because of who I am, because I'm basically a person that always looks good, is that I fall flat apart, that other people, they would take one of you nice people, any in the room, and you know, and they would love you back into wellness. That's what I've always seen people do. I see these cute little women, you know, and they just fall apart, and they're just so sweet and pathetic, and God, you guys, just, you just love them, and you women just love them, and, you know, they just cuddle, shit. I'll tell you, I have an emotional break, you know, and people just simply want to get away from me. They just think, you know, one more time, I'm being an irritant. And so I had an emotional break. Nobody gave a shit. And I packed my bags and went to San Francisco to be a hippie. It made sense to me. Now, I truly believe that I was the only person in the Haight-Ashbury in 1964 that was an outsider. You know, I was in a whole culture of misfits, and I didn't fit. I mean, I was living right in the Haight. I was doing what the people in the Haight did, you know. I would sit around in these dreary little rooms with pictures of the white rabbit on the wall and go, oh, wow. You know? And I'll tell you, for a speed freak, this is not fun. I never figured this out. You know, they'd sit around and just groove out on this stuff, and I would just be antsy. I mean, I'd be ready to move. And so that, and because I've always worked, I was really quite popular in the Haight because I was a person with a car. And anybody that had anything in the Haight-Ashbury was pretty popular. But I never, God saved me from everything. Like, basically, who I was an obnoxious, naive, little brat from Aloha, Oregon. What did I know about living in San Francisco in the middle of this subculture? I mean, I knew nothing. I'd go wandering the streets at night going, hi, brother, you know, and people were dying all around me, sticking needles in their arms, being killed in the panhandle, you know? I mean, and I just thought I was perfectly safe. And God just let me be safe. I mean, there's things that, you know, one thing I love about being in a room full of alcoholics is that somebody in this room has done everything. Okay? There's somebody in this room that has done whatever the rest of you say I'll never do. Somebody's done it. And I have always known that had the situation presented itself at the right moment, I would have done anything. Because I always did. It's just God kept me from the situations that might have killed me. You know? 26 years old, I was getting sick and tired again, folks. And my boss was a widower, and with money, power, and prestige. And I was getting real tired of just kind of holding in there and hanging in there and, you know, sleeping around and doing all that stuff. And I decided I wanted to have a kid before I was too old. Now back then, 26 was getting old. You know, today it's just like your biological clock hasn't even started ticking. But back then it was about dead to the, you know, tits up. And so I decided I wanted this kid before I got too old to have this kid. And this man, who is really a very, very bright man, and a pretty decent bachelor material, I convinced him that I was something other than what I was. And I remember doing it. Now, I don't know how many of you are actors, but that's how I, you know, I'd wake up in the morning and decide who I was going to be that day and put on my costume. And I decided, I looked at this guy and I thought, now, who would he want to marry? And I became that person. I changed my hair. I got rid of my long braid. I changed the way I dressed. I went from my hippie clothes to conservative working clothes. I changed the way I talked, you know. And I went with this man for a year, and he didn't catch it. You know, he didn't catch it. So how bright was he really? Yeah. Now, I remember, his first wife had died of alcoholism at 34 years old. She died of cirrhosis of the liver. And it was not a pretty death. And he sat there one night before we got married, and he says, you know, you surely remind me of Ruth. I said, pardon? He says, well, you don't seem to drink very well. I said, oh, just had a bad day at the office, honey. You know? And this sucker married me. You know? I mean, he really married me. And that's always just kind of blown me away. And I had my baby, and that's really all I wanted. You see, the reason I had to have a man with money is because I had to have a man that was going to pay child support when I split. Because I'm not a person that sticks around. And I knew that from the get-go. You know? And he was the perfect choice because it was kind of selective breeding. You know? I mean, he had all these nice qualities that I would like to have in a child, you know, and it's worked out quite well. His nice qualities have kind of counteracted my basically weird qualities, and the kid turned out real good. But the last thing I'll talk about before I got sober was the worst thing that happened to me after I had that kid. And I had two stepchildren, and the 3 years that I was married to my ex-husband, not from 1969 to 1972, in 1970, the government cracked down on substances. And substances involved my Dexamil, my Dexedrine. And my suppliers dried up, and I couldn't get speed anymore. And I went from being a fun and interesting, if a bit wide-eyed, drinker to a drunk. And I became a drunken woman in that marriage. He was a heavy drinker. We had all the money we needed. I didn't have to work. And I became a daily drinker, starting at noon, always starting at noon with my wine. And I would drink my jug of wine, and then I would switch to scotch at 5 o'clock because I was a lady. And I'd pass out or black out, and that went on for 3 years. Sometime in there, my son was probably 9 months old, and the doctor had given me some tranquilizers to calm my nerves. God knew I was nervous. And I don't take them because I was never interested in downers. I mean, to me, that's just really boring. But I was just really uptight and crazy, and I needed to come down. And so I took a tranquilizer, I took a Librium, and then I took another Librium, and then I had a gin and tonic. And I used to make my gin and tonics in milkshake glasses, you know, like this. And, you know, the doctor would say, how many drinks do you have before dinner? I'd say, two, you know, and it'd be just like that. And I don't know how many of those Libriums I took, but I know I only had two of my small drinks. And I remember packing up my son down in San Francisco and putting him in my car and leaving one more time. And the next thing I knew, I was waking up outside of Salem on I-5 trying to figure out where I was. And the baby was throwing up in the car seat next to me. And I had driven all that way in a blackout. And Scotty was so sick, and the car smelled terrible, and I didn't know where I was, and I didn't know what I was going to do, you know. And I had to drive on into Aloha, Oregon, and face my parents looking like that with that poor baby being so awful. And I never took another goddamn tranquilizer, I'll tell you. But that was probably, you know, I look back on things that I have done, and I've done a million things to myself. But the thought of driving with that baby in that car, that distance, and being totally unaware, you know, and a just total blackout just scares the hell out of me. I don't know how it happens. I don't know how we do it. I can't imagine how our mind continues to function, you know, when it's basically shut down. Because I must have stopped for gas and all that stuff. Probably a year later, or 9 months later, I was drunk like I was drunk every other day. And I came up out of a fog at like 7 o'clock at night, and I screamed in my head, my God, there's got to be another way, you know. And Alcoholics Anonymous just tripped through my head. Now, Alcoholics Anonymous is not something that I would wanted to do. I had been sent to my first AA meeting when I was 21 years old by my boss. I worked for the J.C. Ski School, and they sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was embarrassing them on the mountain. And it was a joke. I mean, I didn't belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 21 years old. I was hip, slick, and cool. I was thin and young and wonderful and having a good time, you know, and these people had no sense of humor. But 7 years later, when I couldn't go on, Alcoholics Anonymous was right there. Didn't even, you know, my God, there has to be another way. And Alcoholics Anonymous was there. And I had my ex-husband call Alcoholics Anonymous, and they called me back, and this woman, her name was Rusty, and she said to me on the phone, she said, "My dear," she says, "I'm having a dinner party for 16 people, and I can't possibly take you to a meeting." She says, "However, there's a meeting in the Arinda Church at 8 o'clock, and if you wish to get sober, get your ass to it." Now, that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, so some of you will understand my approach, you know? Now, I couldn't have come any other way. I'm not a person that appreciates people being nice to me, but that woman was honest with me. You know, she basically kicked me in the butt and said, "It's up to you, honey." And, you know, if she would have come and coddled me and patted me on the head and told me that everything was going to be okay, I probably would have thrown up. But she didn't, and I got to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was drunk on my butt, you know, and I was obnoxious, and I was loud, and if you think I'm bad, clean and sober, not even close to what I am, drunk and loaded, you know, and I talked through the whole meeting, and at the end of the meeting, there was a room of 50 people, and they were just, you know, they were so nice to me. I mean, they were giving me these awful looks, but they were really nice to me. You know, and they finally, the chairwoman said, she says, "Now, young lady, would you like to say something?" And I said, "Well, I don't think so." I said, "It's obvious to me that you're all too old and ugly, and you don't know how to you don't know how to laugh at yourselves." And this whole room just burst out, "Keep coming back." Okay. Now, the reason I tell you that is because let's remember what Alcoholics Anonymous is for, all right? Now, if because I was drunk, they wouldn't have let me into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, or because I was disruptive, they would have asked me to leave. You know, I probably would have died out there. You know, I see people in Alcoholics Anonymous today that have no idea what a drunk looks like anymore. You know? And let's remember why we're here. I mean, I would have died, but they just let me be. They just let me be. Alcoholics Anonymous is for drunks. Thank you very much. So anyway, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did keep coming back, and it's the only place I ever went in my life where I made a total ass of myself, and I kept coming back, and I kept coming back, and I kept coming back. And for 3 months, I came back, and I said, "My name's Sam," and I dared them to make me say, and I'm an alcoholic. I wouldn't say it. I said, "My name's Sam." Okay? And they always called on me. God knew I needed to talk. Yeah, and he's since known that I've always needed to talk. 3 months later, that was February 2nd, 1972. 3 months later, in May, or whenever that is, knowing without a shadow of a doubt, without a doubt in my heart that I was alcoholic, I drank again. Yeah. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. Justifiable. Rationalizing. See, I was married to this man with money, property, and prestige. In sobriety, or being sober, or not drinking, or being dry, I didn't know what to do with him. I was 28 years old, and I had never screwed sober. You know? And he would look at me, and I would look at him, and that's as far as we got. I mean, there was no way. I mean, you want me to what? Pardon? Couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. You know? I mean, my motives for marrying him were not love, all right? We're not talking pure motives here. I didn't get sober and all of a sudden think that this was the most wonderful person in the world. But I didn't want to drink again. I really didn't want to drink again, but I didn't want to have to leave him either. You know, I finally had everything that I always thought that I needed to be successful. You know, the beautiful house and the businesses and the cars and the boats and, you know, all that stuff. I finally had it. And I thought I needed that, and I couldn't... God, the thought of being out there on my own again and raising that child by myself was just... I couldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. I refused to do it. And we set out for a weekend, and I got myself a bottle of scotch. And I'll tell you, I went on a drunk that, thank God, I can only remember pieces and jingles and jangles of it. And I think it lasted for 3 days. And when I came off that sucker, I was willing to do whatever I had to do to never drink again. Because things happened to me in those 3 days that in all my years of being on the streets and being hip, slick, and cool and running around and doing what I wanted to do had never happened to me. You know, they didn't happen to nice little girls from Aloha, Oregon. They happened to me. And I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, you know, my name's Sam and I'm an alcoholic. And I cried and I cried and I cried and I cried. You know, that's the last time I cried for a long time, but God, I cried that night. In July of that year, me and the kid packed our bags and we left California. And Scotty was 20 months old. And I went from being real rich to being real poor. And I came back to Oregon, God knows why. You know, I came back here for support, to be around family, people that loved me. Jesus, did you hear me talk about these people at the beginning of the meeting? What was I thinking? I mean, there's no way. You know, they were the very same people that I had left several years before. They didn't think I was alcoholic, you know? They always thought I was just strange, obnoxious, that I would just do things just to irritate the world. So here I was, me and the kid and nobody, absolutely nobody. Got myself a job, got myself an apartment, got myself a babysitter, and got myself to meetings. Now I'll tell you, Portland, Oregon in 1972 was probably the most boring place in the world to get sober. Trust me. Just, Trimble was there. He was one of the bores. I'm serious. You know, he was going through, let me talk about you for a while. I get so bored with myself. He was going through his sainthood stage. You know? It's like everybody in Portland was going through their sainthood stage. You know, and most of them just stayed in it. You know, and they bored me to death. I mean, I would walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in this dreary old URS club, which none of you will ever see because it's long gone. And there would be 15, 20 old people. Now, I know that the kids in the room think I'm pretty old. And now, you know, I'm a hell of a lot older than I used to be. But compared to them, honey, I'm still a teenager. These folks were old. Trimble looks 20 years younger than he did 15 years ago. That's because he started smiling, for God's sakes. Nobody smiled. And I thought, I'm going to die. I mean, I'm going to die. I'm not going to make it. Okay? There is no way. I mean, it was just like being in my home where people wouldn't let me laugh and they wouldn't let me cry and they wouldn't let me slam doors. And I thought, I'm going to die in Alcoholics Anonymous and I got no place else to go. And I made some major decisions based on my needs, based on what I needed from you people. And one of those decisions was, you know, I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to win a popularity contest. And if they don't like who I am, tough shit, because I'm going to stay sober, regardless. Regardless. And if I have to be the most unpopular person in the world, I don't care, because I'm going to say what I got to say. And believe me, I had a lot to say. I was angry. I had a lifetime of pent-up emotions and words that people had tried to keep me silent for so long that when I got here, I needed to talk. And these old farts, God bless them, God knew they needed to listen. They didn't have a lot of choice, you know? God bless Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody ever asked me to leave a meeting. Now, you know, I still use four-letter words, but, oh, I'm just a saint compared to who I used to be. Believe me. You know, things were not like it is today. I mean, I was not a socially acceptable human being. And people just let me be. They didn't necessarily like it. I didn't care if they liked it or not. But they didn't kick me out. You know, and some of the old-timers, I mean, the old-timers, you know, just loved me. They loved me anyway. There's this one old fart that lives over in Bend now, and he's an old big book thumper, you know, God, no humor at all, just an old grump, you know. But he used to say to me, he says, you know, even porcupines have to make love. And I said, bet me, asshole. You know? So it was just me and the kid and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was 27, 28 years old. And nobody was 28 years old in Alcoholics Anonymous back then. I mean, I'm serious. Nobody. And nobody ever, 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 ever talked about drugs. You know, it's one of the things that, you know, I feel just really strongly about this, you see, because people didn't talk about drugs. Nobody mentioned drugs. So I'll tell you, I had been in Portland 6 months before Christmas came that year, and I was working at a place where everybody smoked dope and ate marijuana brownies, and nobody told me not to. Yeah. Nobody told me not to. Nobody ever mentioned it. I didn't know that I couldn't smoke dope and be an Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. Or that sober meant sober, sober meant drug-free, sober meant clean from any mood-altering chemicals. Never heard that word. Mood-altering pardons? You know? People didn't talk like that in 1972. I mean, they told their drunkologues. Very seldom did I hear anybody talk about a feeling, talk about a need, talk about a desire, a frustration, a fear, you know? I mean, I was surrounded by people that were 82 and a half years old, and they came to Alcoholics Anonymous and found God and lived happily ever after, and I'm so glad. You know? But I smoked dope Christmas 1972, several times, I might add, okay? Because I know a good thing when I find it. And, you know, it took me 5 years. Do you like that? I do that because I'm not sure. Somewhere around 5 years of sobriety, and some old fart that can't make it on this program that's been around for about 30 years now was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous sober for one of the days of his life, bless his heart, and he said to me, Sam, this is a program of rigorous honesty. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm about as honest as I know how to be. He said, Sam, this is a program of rigorous honesty. And Sam, this is a program of rigorous honesty. And at that meeting, I thought, I don't know what he's talking about, but let's try this, you know? And I took a year off my sobriety date. And that hurt like a son of a bitch. It really screwed up my story, for one thing. I had at that time, I had tapes out there saying I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, never drank again, you know? I mean, I don't know who you think you are, but when I came to this program, I was Looney Tunes. I didn't remember that I had even drank again. You know? My sobriety date was February 2nd, 1972. I forgot that I drank again. I mean, I was nutso. I tell people the only thing they need to do their first year of sobriety is not drink or drug. You know? You don't drink or drug. Oh, well, Jesus, I've got to work the steps. I've got to do step 9. I've got to do step 12. I've got to do step 11. I've got to get back to the church. I've got to make all my amends. I've got to. They're running around, you know, just going in a frenzy. It's kind of like an eating frenzy, like Pac-Man. You know, I got to have it all. And my God, you know, take a deep breath. Take a deep breath. All you really got to do if you want to make this program is not drink or drug or kill yourself, you know. And then things are going to start working. You give yourself time. I mean, God, work the steps for sure. But don't think it's going to be the only time. You know? Don't think just because, you know, oh, geez, well, I made a decision that I turned my will and my life over to the care of God, and I feel so good. Well, I think that's wonderful. But trust me, you're going to have to do it again. And again. And again. You know? I mean, I don't know how many poor steps I've done. you know, and fifth steps, and ninth steps, and tenth steps. But you just keep plugging. I think that, you know, we beat ourselves up. And thank God, you know, for some reason I knew that all I had to do was not drink or drug. Because I guarantee you I didn't make any major changes my first year of sobriety. Well, yes, I did, you know. I smoked dope. Scratched that year. Okay, into year two here, okay, which now becomes year one. Okay. Into year two, I got into a relationship that was just wonderful, okay? The thing that was really wonderful about it is that most of my relationships up to this point, excluding the 10-week marriage and excluding the 3-year marriage, which was long-term only because I had a baby, were 3 weeks or learning their last name, whichever came first. And I brought that with me into sobriety. I mean, that's not something that I changed immediately. One of the things that... I won't talk about that. Yes, I will. I think it's real important. You know, I hear just a lot of people being real condemning. You know, you can't do... if you're going to do that, you can't stay sober. And if you're going to do that, you can't stay sober. And if you're going to do that, you're going to get loaded again. That's bullshit, folks. I'll tell you something. The only thing that's going to get you drunk or loaded is picking up that first drink or drug. You know, and you're going to make mistakes. You're not a saint. I'm not a saint. There's not a saint around. You know, we're going to make mistakes, but you don't have to drink a drug. And if you don't drink a drug, you're going to get through it, you know? And you'll come out and you'll say, gee, that didn't work too well. I think I'll stop doing that. You know, that one didn't work. And my first year in the program, I went on what I call my guilt-free sex trip. You know, I had to learn how to screw sober. I didn't know how. And God... I wouldn't do that today. Like, my purse is not big enough to carry all those condoms in. But back then, that really wasn't an issue, you know. And there are so many things that if I could have done it different, I would have done it different. But I couldn't do it different. For one thing, I didn't have anybody to talk to. There was nobody around that had the kind of experience, strength, and hope that I needed, because nobody around was less than 82. And if they were doing what I was doing, they weren't talking. Yeah. My sponsors were wonderful, wonderful, wonderful women. But we really didn't talk about the things that I needed to talk about. And I didn't have somebody to take me by the hand and pull me through all this sucker. It's kind of like, you know, I was out there by myself a lot. Just an awful lot. And there wasn't anybody else around that was single and had a baby. You know, and I'd take that baby to meetings, and God, he was still in diapers, and he was just the cutest little shit, you know. And I thought he would drive me crazy. I was telling somebody the other day that the first time I spoke at a speaker's meeting, it was a little speaker's meeting out in Oregon City, and naturally my son was in the audience, and he was probably 3 years old or something like that, and he wouldn't stay in his seat, and nobody could get the kid. And here I was up here trying to talk. Now, you people with kids know, you know, that it's real hard to concentrate when this kid's running all over the place. And finally, they just let him go. They said, screw it, we can't take care of this kid anymore. We can take care of her, you know. And the kid came up and grabbed onto my leg. Now, there was not a podium like this, okay? It was just like a little thing that you hang onto. And this little 3-year-old hung onto my leg the whole time I talked. I mean, you know, that was... People didn't talk like that in Alcoholics Anonymous, dragging this kid around. I mean, I had this kid, and I didn't know what to do with him. I brought him to meetings because I didn't have much money. I guarantee I didn't have much money. I mean, we were real poor, and... There were so many times that I didn't know how I was going to feed just me and the kid. I didn't know how I was going to get the kid a can of soup for dinner. And, you know, people look at me today, and I used to hate women, smug, asshole women, you know, with their husbands at home and their 2-car garages and their 3 television sets and, you know, how hip, slick, and cool they thought they were in their nice clothes and their darling children, you know. I was out there just really afraid that I was going to have to go stand in the line at the Blanchet house to feed my son. You know, and you'd sit around, you'd talk about how wonderful everything was. Well, how wonderful is it when you're afraid your kid's going to go hungry? You know, but the truth of the matter is that I'd go over to the Alano Club over on the west side, and I'd bitch, and I'd moan, and I'd holler, and those old farts over there, they say, they can't eat you, Sam. Yeah, they can't eat you. Watch them! You know, they were turning off my phone. They were turning off my electricity. I'd barely get it together, and something would come up, you know. I mean, if something coming up would be like a flat tire. I mean, big deal stuff. You know, how am I going to get enough gas to go to work? The first thing that came out of my paycheck was babysitter money so that I could go to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I hear people moan and groan and bitch and holler because they can't get to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I'll tell you, you do whatever you got to do. You just do it. Anyway, I made it through early sobriety. Me and the kid made it through early sobriety, and I don't talk much about my kid in Alcoholics Anonymous because we had some bad times. Like I said, I was not a stable person, okay? And I did not know how to be a mother. And, God, this kid was wonderful, but I wasn't. And sometimes I just wanted to throw him into a wall. And I truly believe the only reason that I did not physically abuse that kid is because I was not a physically abused child. You know, I mean, sometimes I would pick him up, and I was so frantic. And I don't know how your minds were in early sobriety, or if you're still in early sobriety, how your minds are. But I would get so tight that I wouldn't know what to do, and the kid wouldn't shut up. And the more tight I got, the louder the kid would get, you know, and I just want to throw him into a wall. And God gave me the most wonderful babysitter in the world, and I could drop that kid off day or night at her house because she understood that kid might be the only place that he would be safe. Anyway, the kid and I made it. He's 17 years old now. He does not drink or drug. Thank you, God, you know. I mean, that has nothing to do with me. It has to do with just pure grace. Just pure grace. It even doesn't even have to do with, you know, dragging his little ass to meetings for most of his life. It just has to do with grace. Someday when he picks up his first drink or drug, who knows what will happen, but so far he hasn't, and I'm forever grateful. 6 years into sobriety, this is what I always say, sobriety tongue-in-cheek, okay? Sobriety for you is probably something different than sobriety was for me. I didn't drink or drug or kill myself. And at 5 years, I had another emotional break. And now that was at 6 years. That's what's coming up now. I got sick and tired of being sick and tired in sobriety, so I got married. Oh, God help us. You know, I think it's amazing I lasted that long. But, you know, there was all these Al-Anon women in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. Bless your hearts. I love you dearly. But they always thought that I was after their man. You know, and I used to look around those rooms and I'd say, you've got to be kidding me. Why would I want him? You know? And I really was saved by the grace of God. There was just nobody that, you know, turned my crank. And I was too busy being crazy. So, and, you know, having all these little things that I did. And I really, except for my first relationship with this crazy Larry that was so wonderful and that I went crazy over, I stayed... Okay, I'll tell you the truth. Okay. the truth is that I went with this guy for a year. We had this wonderful relationship. He left me. Nobody leaves me, okay? And so I fell apart. And then on the rebound, I moved in with this other guy, and then someplace in there, I slept with this other guy in the program. So there's three guys in the program that I had slept with. And I walked into the old URS club one day, and they were all shooting pool.
At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine.